listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. When Rosa Parks died in 2005, just after Hurricane Katrina, historian Jean Theo Harris was, like so many others, both captivated and horrified by the national spectacle made of her death. As she writes in her compelling biography, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, quote, "The national honor for Rosa Parks served to obscure the present injustices facing the nation. Bearing the history of American racism was politically useful and increasingly urgent, as Katrina threatened to disrupt the idea of a colorblind America." As Theo Harris began to research the civil rights heroine, she realized how little we actually knew of Rosa Parks. Her brilliant book, which examines Parks' 6 decades of activism, is a corrective which will help put to rest the fable of the, quote, "not angry Rosa Parks." It tells the story of an activist with a long-standing anger at social injustice. As New York Times columnist Charles Blow summed up in his exuberant review, actually a whole column on Jean Theo Harris's book, quote, "Most of what you think you know about Rosa Parks may well be wrong. The romanticized children's book story of a meek seamstress with aching feet who just happened into history in a moment of uncalculated resistance is pure mythology." This is an activist who is as much Malcolm X as she is Martin Luther King. Jean Theo Harris is the author of numerous books and articles on the civil rights and black power movements, the politics of race and education, social welfare, and civil rights in post-9/11 America. She's currently a professor of political science at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. And we also want to congratulate Jean on The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks recently being nominated for an NAACP Image Award in the biography category. And we have other exciting guests in store for you tonight. In conversation with Jean Theo Harris, we're delighted to welcome activist Erica Huggins and author-scholar Robin Kelly. Erica Huggins is a former Black Panther Party member, political prisoner, human rights activist, poet, and teacher. She's lectured throughout the United States on the restoration of human rights, whole child education, family reunification, restorative justice, and the role of spiritual practice in sustaining activism and promoting social change. We are so honored to have her here tonight. Robin D.G. Kelly is the Gary B. Nash Professor of American History at UCLA. His most recent book is Africa Speaks, America Answers, Modern Jazz and Revolutionary Times, and among his many other publications, the prize-winning Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communist During the Great Depression, Yo Mama's Dysfunctional, Fighting the Culture Wars in Urban America, and 3 Strikes, Miners, Musicians, and Sales Girls, and the Fighting Spirit of Labor's Last Century, written collaboratively with Dana Frank and Howard Zinn, and Freedom Dreams, the Black Radical Imagination. Please join me in welcoming Jean Theo Harris, Erica Huggins, and Robin D.G. Kelly to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
To get settled here. Well, first of all, it's a real honor to be sitting in this seat talking to these incredible, amazing thinkers, writers, activists. Erica Huggins is someone whose name I knew when I was about 7 years old, actually, and someone who is both, you know, as Louise mentioned, a wonderful and important American activist, revolutionary, but also a really brilliant scholar and poet. Jean Theo Harris is someone I've known many years, even when she was a graduate student at University of Michigan years ago, and she has given us this remarkable book. And before we begin our conversation, you really can't leave here without buying that book. I mean, it would be an embarrassment if you don't own the book, because there's not a biography like it. Rosa Parks is one of those figures who everyone thinks they know. She is the most beloved icon in American social movements. She's the person that people feel comfortable with. And when you read this book, you're going to feel uplifted and powerfully uncomfortable with her militancy, with her uncompromising sort of opposition to social injustice, with her long-distance willingness to keep fighting on every single front, and her presence in a place like Detroit, which, of course, Detroit has its own history, which she's very much a part of that. So I really want to encourage you to get the book, and I want to begin. Actually, I want to open up by asking Jean to talk about a very famous, iconic image of Rosa Parks. This is the one we always see, and we'll get to that. And it's the image of Rosa Parks being fingerprinted. You know, we see this, and it's, you know, it plays into, at least not so much it plays into, but the narrative around this image is always, here's this, you know, seamstress, her feet are tired, she can't take it any longer, so she ends up being arrested. She's cooperative, she's demure, she's everything that even the opposition civil rights movement loves. That is, she's not angry, she's just a tired old lady. And then that begins the whole civil rights movement. Talk about that image, what it means in your reading of it.
Well, one of the first things about this image, right, is it's not what we think it is. Right? Most of the time when you see this image, it's identified as Rosa Parks being arrested in 1955 with her bus arrest. Right? This, in fact, is a picture taken 3 months later, well into the boycott. One of the things the city does to try to break the boycott is they arrest 90 of the boycott leaders. It is only at that moment where there is enough press attention to get a picture of Rosa Parks being fingerprinted. Right, and the second iconic picture, which I think we have, is her mugshot picture, which again is usually what we think we see here, right, is Rosa Parks being arrested, which it is, but it is actually well into the boycott when they have made this into a movement such that that there will be press there. There is no press when Rosa Parks is arrested, and that... We wanted to start with these pictures in many ways because I think they serve as a metaphor for what we think we know about, right, the accidental actor, right? When Rosa Parks dies in 2005, the New York Times eulogizes her as the accidental matriarch of the civil rights movement.
Right.
There's nothing accidental about Rosa Parks's stand that day. There is nothing accidental, in part, as Robin was saying, because it is in the midst of a lifetime of political activism and political work. I think many of us, even now as elementary school students, learn that Rosa Parks is courageous, right? Everyone here probably. But in fact, what makes Rosa Parks courageous is something that is missed in that accidental actor story, which is that Rosa Parks had, for the two decades before she makes that bus stand December 1st, 1955, been fighting injustice, been fighting segregation, been fighting for black voter registration. She really begins that life when she meets and falls in love with the first real activist she ever met, and that is Raymond Parks, who she will fall in love with and marry. Mm-hmm. The seeds of it are actually born in her family, born with her mother and her grandfather, who told her that to be respectable was, in fact, also to expect respect from other people, to demand respect from other people. So as a young person, Rosa Parks sat out with her grandfather on the porch when he would sit out at night to protect their family's house from the Klan with his shotgun. She would sit with him. Mm-hmm. When she was a young person, she would, if somebody pushed her, she would push back. And then beginning really in the book, and I talk about kind of meeting Raymond as sort of the beginning of her adult political work. And right. So they began with the Scottsboro case. And then she will spend two decades working on voter registration with the NAACP and issues of criminal justice.
Right. You might say something about the Scottsboro case for those people who may not be familiar with it.
Scottsboro is 1931. This is in the midst of the Great Depression. Lots of people would ride the rails, right? That's basically riding the trains for free. These nine young men are riding the rails, ages 12 to 19. They are arrested for riding the rails. And they, as they're being arrested, two young white women are also found riding the rails. But that charge for those young men quickly changes to rape, and those nine young men are charged and very quickly sentenced to death, all
right.
Except the youngest one.
Right.
Now, a grassroots local movement grows in Alabama to try to protect and defend the Scottsboro boys from being executed. And one of the local activists in Alabama that is part of that grassroots movement that grows is Raymond Parks. And so he is working on the Scottsboro case when she meets him, and they get married in December of 1932, and she joins him in that dangerous work. She talks about late night meetings, guns all over the table, because even to have a meeting about this was dangerous. Right. He talks about how in many of these meetings they all went by the name Larry, so they didn't even know each other's names out of the fear that they would be asked to identify each other. So this is where her political activism begins, and in the beginning he's the more public activist, and she's more behind the scenes. And that will switch over the course of their relationship, and she will become the more public activist, and he will be more behind the scenes. But it is very much a kind of partnership, a political and romantic. I mean, it's obviously a romance, but at the heart of that romance is a shared sort of political commitment that then takes her forward. And then by the 1940s, she will join the NAACP, and she and Edie Nixon will work to transform the NAACP in Montgomery into a much more active and activist branch. It's a very small group at this point. It is extremely dangerous work. She spends much of the 1940s traveling Alabama, taking people's accounts of either white brutality, white sexual violence, or cases of legal lynching, again, like the Scottsboro case, where typically young black men would be tried and convicted for crimes they did not commit. And so they spend that decade before the bus stand really working on these issues of criminal justice, of black voter registration, of school segregation. And so to get back to this kind of the iconic image of Rosa Parks' courage and what makes her courageous, I very much argue in the book that part of that courage is the courage of persistence. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, what is missed by that accidental, tired vision of her is, in fact, what makes that act so incredible is that she's done it before. She's known people who've done it before, and it hasn't worked, and there's no reason to think it's going to work. Right. And she's also known one of her neighbors, she's living in the projects at this point, and one of her neighbors is killed for his bus resistance in 1950. She talks about how she's not sure she's going to get off the bus alive. There are all sorts of stories about black women being pulled off buses by police and being raped.
Right, and this is not her first time either.
Right, this is not
important.
Right, she had resisted with this bus driver before this. Some bus drivers in Montgomery would make black people pay in the front, but then have to reboard and get on in the back. And Rosa Parks refused to do this. And so she was kicked off by this very same bus driver a decade earlier, and she'd been kicked off other bus drivers' buses for being too uppity because she refused this practice. So this is not at all her first time. And so there's nothing to suggest that this is going to be different, and yet pushed as far as she could be pushed, she refuses. And she talks about it as both doing what she'd asked of others. So she locates her decision to stand fast, both in terms of a larger organizing tradition that she's a part of, and also the tradition of civil disobedience, which is that to her, to stand up was to consent. And she did not consent.
Right. Before I bring in Erica, let me ask just one more question. So we're going to jump over the actual moment, 1955, in the bus boycott. She and Raymond leave Alabama in 1957 and move to Detroit.
Right.
Why did they leave? And Under what conditions did they leave? In other words, what did the movement do in terms of supporting her work in Alabama?
So a month into the boycott, Rosa Parks loses her job. She's working at Montgomery Fair. She's an assistant tailor in the men's shop. She loses her job. Shortly after that, Raymond is barbering, but he's barbering at the Maxwell Air Force Base. And the owner there says he refuses that there can be no talk of the boycott or that woman in the shop. And for a proud political man like Raymond, that's untenable. Because his chair in his shop had always been a place for discussion, for political talk, and so the idea that he could not talk about his wife, about this boycott, was, again, impossible for Raymond. So basically, 1 month into the boycott, both of them have lost their jobs. So the Parks family spends the boycott with no... They never find steady work again in Montgomery. They survive in part. She's doing some sewing on the side. He's doing some barbering on the side. But they mostly survive because white activist Virginia Durr realizes how much trouble they are in and fundraises among her white leftist colleagues around the country. So the Parks are in sort of deep financial trouble, even though Rosa Parks actually spends the year of the boycott mostly on the road fundraising for the boycott itself.
Right. In fact, can we see the other image of in the front of the courthouse as you tell the story?
Right. So there's first the kind of economic sacrifice. And so she's going around, she's having all of this incredible sort of traveling in the midst of this economic instability of her own family. The second thing is they're getting fairly constant sort of death threats, hate calls, so much so that her mother's living with them, and her mother takes to talking on the phone for hours at a time because the calls are so ugly, and they're so horrible, and they're so relentless, that Raymond actually suffers a nervous breakdown in the midst of the boycott. The boycott successfully ends, right, December 20th, 1956. The buses in Montgomery are desegregated, but the Parks still cannot find work, and they are still getting sort of death threats. There is some controversy within the group that gets started to sort of spearhead the boycott is called the Montgomery Improvement Association. And there's some controversy. Edie Nixon and other people, mostly Nixon actually, is trying to get the Montgomery Improvement Association to hire Rosa Parks. He realizes that, you know, she is in trouble. She is not hired. She is extremely proud. So she's never one to ask for help. They are continuing to get these hate calls. And so basically 8 months after the Montgomery bus boycott ends, the Parks family basically are forced to leave Montgomery and they move to Detroit. Her younger brother, Sylvester, is at this point living in Detroit, working in the auto industry. And they move to Detroit to what she describes as the promised land that wasn't. Because I think if most of us know, the last sentence of the Rosa Parks biography is always, and she moves to Detroit, and it's like it's the happy ever after, it's the vacation home, it's the happy epilogue of the story. When in fact, she will spend more than half of her political life fighting the racism of the Jim Crow North. Because what she says is she doesn't find too much difference between the structures of policing, of schools, of jobs, of housing, from what they leave in Montgomery to what they find in Detroit.
Right, right. So I want to move to Erica. And before that, you know, it's interesting about the review that was read that described Rosa Parks as both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. I think of her as Rosa Parks, as neither. And in fact, part of this idea of the icon is to turn them into something that, in fact, it's turning Malcolm X and Martin Luther King into something greater than the human beings that they are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this is a story of a woman, an activist, who is dealing with certain kinds of constraints as a woman, as a black woman, both in the South and the North. So I want to ask, Erica, I want to begin with your story. Because you are a long, long distance runner, you know. You're an activist who everyone knows of you from the work you did at Black Panther Party, but they also know of you sometimes as, you know, John Huggins' widow. And so the idea of, again, being a woman in a movement identified with men, and also being in struggle for so long, and all the work that you're doing, if you could tell us your story, how you got into movement, the work that you've done, the constraints and struggles that you've dealt with, and just how it sort of shaped your life.
How much time do I have?
You got as much time as much time as you want.
Well, I want to say first, thank you. I'm always thanking Jean for this book. It is absolutely not only a book you want to buy for yourself, but you want to buy it and give it to people who you love, because it will educate them and open a part. It opens a part of people's minds and hearts that they're not aware were barriered. Because when we make a person an icon, they're no longer human.
Right.
They don't breathe. They don't cry. And they don't laugh. They're statues, as we were talking about earlier. And certainly Rosa Parks was not that. And I'll come back to telling a story about meeting her. And it was an amazing day. But when I was 15 years old, I went to the March on Washington. And the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. And I made note that day that there were no women who spoke. I didn't know what I was seeing. I was 15. I just made note of it. I thought it was interesting. But I was so delighted to be there all by myself at age 15. And on that day, I made a vow to serve people for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea how that vow would unfold and what the threads of life would weave together. And then I went to college. I wanted to be a teacher. And while I was in college at a historical black university, Lincoln University,
Pennsylvania,
outside of Philadelphia, I met John Huggins. And at this time, we heard about the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very amazed that young black men and women were saying no. And Martin Luther King said no, Rosa Parks said no, but we were saying no in a different way.
Right.
And there was a burgeoning student movement, there were movements to end the war in Vietnam. The gay liberation movement, as it was called then, was blossoming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The women's movement, the movement of Native peoples, the American Indian movement, the Brown Berets, the Young Lords, anything that could move was moving. And we certainly wanted to be a part of it. And so we left Lincoln University to drive across the country and join the Black Panther Party and participate in the Defense Committee for Huey Newton.
Right, and drive across the country to Oakland.
To Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We got here to the Huey Newton birthday rally in February of 1967. Was it February of 67? No, we got here in November of 67, and then it was February 68 mm-hmm. where this huge rally to support Huey. And the most touching thing, and it sort of endeared me to movements of all kinds, was when Huey's mother stood to say, "I don't have very much to say, but just free my baby." And I was so touched. And so we poured ourselves into uplifting people, but not as the media told you we did.
Right.
The media told you story after story about all kinds of things, but what we were doing was, well, John was a student at UCLA, and I was speaking to high school students, and we all talked to people in the community. We were getting legal help for people who were being imprisoned for no reason, because the police brutality that you talked about in Rose's time and the mass incarceration that was beginning to spread like wildfire was right there in front of us.
Right.
All the interventions that people have made over time didn't stop it, but we kept going. I forgot to say that, or did I, that I was 18 when I joined the Black Panther Party.
I didn't say that.
And I married John, and he was a student at UCLA, as I said, and the FBI counterintelligence program killed him and Al Prentice Bunchy Carter on the UCLA campus. Mm-hmm. January 17th, 1969. And we know now that the COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI, did all kinds of heinous acts. Terrorist acts.
Right, exactly. And so in terms of your, if you could talk a little bit about your relationship to the Black Panther Party coming out of the experience of the March for Jobs and Justice and Freedom. You know, there's a way, and I ask this question because what's wonderful about this book and about your life and about the lives of many others is that the kinds of divide between so-called civil rights and Black power are not so sharp.
No.
It's a Black freedom movement. And so there's a way in which your lives so connect. The fact that legal defense was an issue in L.A. in 1968-69 as it was in Alabama in the 1930s and as it is today. So we could talk about just the trajectory of moving from, you know, these, from the sort of civil rights movement, the connection to movements that are associated with Rosa Parks initially, and then your own experience with Black Panther Party, and we're going to talk about it.
Well, for me, I cannot speak for everybody, not even every member of the Black Panther Party, because we were all unique. We are all unique individuals. Mm-hmm. But for me, there was no gap. It was this continuum, and we were in that continuum. I do want to say that I loved when Malcolm X said that civil rights are not enough, because civil rights are the rights you do by law, and human rights are the rights that you do by your very birth.
Right.
And so we thought of the movement as a human rights movement, but we didn't see it as an instead of the civil rights movement, because we were still fighting for civil rights when we were defending that horrific case that Huey Newton was fighting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And all the other things that happened as a result of COINTELPRO.
Right.
So, and just general police abuse in Los Angeles, in all the big cities of the United States, and the global events happening mm-hmm. right around the world,
right.
Including our stance against the war in Vietnam. And so the truth is that there weren't the gaps that the mainstream narrative wants to tell us there are. We didn't have hate for Martin Luther King, for instance. I'm sure that there were people who felt that he moved more slowly, and we were so young, we felt, well, you know, we said revolution in our lifetime. Well, we didn't understand that the barge takes a long time to turn on the ocean. So we continued our work, and we borrowed a lot. Our community survival programs were actually borrowed mm-hmm. from movements in the South, where people were fed, they were clothed,
right.
they were housed, their roaches and rats were gotten rid of, their plumbing was fixed.
Mm-hmm.
The children were educated in church schools. The Oakland Community School, which I'll talk about in a minute, was not patterned after the Black church schools, but many of us had grandmothers and great-grandmothers mm-hmm. and just family who were educated in those schools because Black children couldn't go to white schools.
Right.
So the churches became a hub for education. And so the survival programs were programs created for poor people. Mm-hmm. And I remember that the Poor People's Campaign was in our awareness. Right. Not at all points, but it certainly was. We weren't ignorant of history.
Exactly.
And we also knew that we had to model, if the government wasn't going to do the clothing and the feeding and providing the health care for people, we would create free medical clinics, and we did. There's a funny story about the first free medical clinic, and it's in a new book by Alondra Nelson.
Alondra Nelson, yeah.
It's a wonderful book. It's called Body and Soul. And my friend Norma Armoram Toomey tells the story that they didn't have an ambulance. They couldn't afford one. So somebody donated a hearse, and they turned the hearse into an ambulance. But they carried people because black people couldn't get picked up. They couldn't afford ambulance service. But even if they could, people wouldn't come to the neighborhoods where black and poor people lived.
Right.
So we were just serving people. However, the mainstream media carried that we were hoodlums that were fighting the police.
Right, right.
So the school, the Oakland Community School, which Rosa Parks visited, was, if the programs were a crown of the Black Panther Party, then the Oakland Community School was the gem in the crown.
Can you show that picture of Erica and Rosa Parks at the Oakland? It's a beautiful picture.
That's a great
picture.
Yeah.
This day is such a magnificent day.
Right.
And my daughter and I and Jean were sort of remembering it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still remember that moment when she came through the door. And there's another photo of a little girl presenting her with a bouquet of roses.
Right.
It was magnificent. That school was a model of education.
Right. So what year was this photograph taken? And if you tell us a little bit about the context of Rosa Parks' comment.
It had to be like 78, mm-hmm. maybe 79. I can't quite remember the year. But we got a call that Rosa was in town and wanted to see this model school that so many people had told her about. This school was for 2.5 to 12-year-old children. It was tuition-free, mm-hmm. community-based, parent-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
It was the curriculum was created to be student-centered so that children could ask about, well, I would like to learn this. Or I want to know more about that. And we just listened to the children. And these are children that came from the nearby project housing and from the cities right around. We were in East Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how many people are familiar with Oakland, but it was at 61st and then East 14th Street, which is now International Boulevard.
Right.
It's a huge black and Latina mm-hmm. neighborhood, stretch of neighborhoods.
Right.
And that school building was a haven. It was an oasis in the community. And so Rosa Parks was told about the school, and she wanted to come and visit, and we wanted her to come and visit, and all of the children and the staff were so excited. And the children wrote a play for Ms. Rosa Parks.
Wow.
About her day on the bus, but more. And the child who portrayed Rosa Parks was not quiet or polite when she said, I'm not getting up. You pushed me
accurate,
too far.
Right.
Yes. But that was her.
Right.
That was. I'm glad she had that characterization
right.
of Rosa.
Right.
And Rosa loved the play. But I want to back up a little bit to tell you the feeling of the day. The children were so excited. And again, these are children from primarily from poor neighborhoods who would have gone to the public schools that were not educating them.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
Right, right.
And then there were the children who were the sons and daughters of members of the Black Panther Party. We had a waiting list every year. Unborn children were on our waiting list. I'm serious. People begged to have their children in our school.
Well, they begged to get into school now. A school like that?
Yes.
Imagine. Yeah.
And not because it had anything to do with the Black Panther Party. A lot of people didn't know that.
Right.
It was because we loved the children that much.
Exactly.
We loved them.
Yeah.
And we knew then, and we didn't believe in punitive education. So the children were all so excited that Rosa was coming. And the grown-up kids were as well. And she came, and she had that moment at the doorway, and she met people. And then she went into our auditorium, where she would see the play of mm-hmm. that a segment of her life. And the children got to ask her questions as well.
Wow, that's great.
And she was so kind right. and gracious right. and happy, as you can see.
Right. Well, this is an opportunity to bring us up to speed in terms of Rosa Parks' life from the time she gets to Detroit to this period when, you know, some of the things you reveal. She was at the Poor People's March after King was assassinated. She was in Gary, Indiana at, you know, the Black Political Convention. She was everywhere. And if you could talk a little bit about that and bring us to that Rosa Parks, the Rosa Parks we know very little about.
So similar to what she'd done in Montgomery, she gets to Detroit, and there's all of this work to be done. And they really struggle. So for the decade after her bus stand, and in many ways, the hero of the middle part of this story is John Conyers.
Mm-hmm.
Rosa Parks volunteers for John Conyers' first campaign for Congress in 1964. He's running. He's a very young civil rights lawyer. It's an open field. They've redistricted in Michigan, so it's a potentially going to send a second Black person to Congress. Michigan already had one. And so eight people are running. John is not favored at all. He's running on a jobs, justice, and peace. So he's an early opponent of the war at Vietnam, like Rosa Parks. He's very active in the labor movement, as is Rosa Parks. She's volunteering. She actually convinces Martin Luther King, who does no political work, to come to Detroit on Conyers' behalf Easter weekend. Does an appearance with John Conyers. John Conyers wins the primary by about 40 votes.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And he very much credits Rosa Parks with that, with getting King and with that win. And so one of the first things that John Conyers does in 1965 is he hires Rosa Parks to work in his Detroit office doing constituent work. So this is her first paid political position. She's been active for more than 20 years. And this is her first paid political position. And this really changes the Parks family sort of economic stability. She had been working at in some sense we might call a glorified sweatshop at Stockton Sewing Company doing piecework. Raymond was barbering, but again, that decade is a very difficult decade. For instance, in 1960, she developed ulcers during the boycott. They land her in the hospital in 1960. They can't afford the hospital. They go into collection. So in many ways, it's John Conyers' sort of decision to hire her in 65 that kind of puts them on a more stable economic path. And then it puts her on the ground, literally, as this kind of emerging many movements, both in Detroit and nationally, both for Black political power, for economic justice, against the war in Vietnam. She's on the ground working in Conyers' office as all of these movements start to blossom in the 1960s. And in order to tell this second half of the story, I did a lot of interviews because Rosa Parks is sort of hidden in plain sight in Detroit. Lots of oral histories of Rosa Parks are done while she's sitting there in John Conyers' office, and yet the interviewers never think to ask any questions about Detroit or about Conyers, right? It's all, what was it like in Montgomery? What was it like? You know, they ask some fill-in, like, you know, what happened before the boycott, And I think this gets us back to gender, right? Because I think it would be hard to imagine sitting with a male civil rights activist turned congressional aide in 1968 in Detroit and not say, what do you think about the war in Vietnam? What do you think the congressman's agenda should be?
Right.
What do you think Detroit needs? Right? But because, I think partly because it's a woman, they don't ask those questions. So I did a lot of interviews to kind of fill in the second half of the story. And over and over and over, I heard from all different sorts of activists, both in Detroit and nationally, that she was everywhere. And that often what she would do, she'd be sitting in the front row, often with some sort of knitting or handwork. She liked to sort of sew while she listened. And she would come to everything from all sorts of Black history lectures, cultural lectures, to rallies, to anti-police brutality events. She did all sorts of what people describe to me as the nitty-gritty work of beginning to elect Black people to various offices, both in Detroit and nationally. She was, as I mentioned, adamantly against the war in Vietnam. So she was active in a whole variety of things, both in Detroit and then also nationally.
And against apartheid in South Africa.
Right. So one of my favorite pictures in the book is a picture of Rosa Parks in her 70s picketing outside the South African embassy with a huge sign that basically dwarfs her body, but she's sort of still going, right? That she also, like many, many other people of the time, many other activists of the time, saw the struggle for sort of Black freedom in the United States intimately connected, right, to the struggles that were happening internationally, independence struggles, anti-colonial struggles. And so that was also a strand, both of what she read. She was a vociferous reader. She read multiple newspapers a day. She was a clipper. This is sort of something that's kind of gone by the wayside, but she had a huge clipping file. She would clip out the articles, and those they're actually at Wayne State in Detroit. And it's an amazing look into the mind of Rosa Parks and sort of all of the issues she was following, both internationally and nationally, sort of in the 60s and 70s. And so her visit to the Oakland Community School was one of hundreds of things that she was doing in that period.
Right.
Yes, and that was what made it so remarkable to me. And I didn't tell you the bit that touched my heart so. Is it okay if I tell this
bit? Yes, I'll tell this bit.
So she sits in the auditorium, and I'm, you know, there were 150 children, but I knew them all, and they were like, they felt like my children. So I always was taking stock of who was where and who wasn't. And I started looking around, and I missed two girls, and I was like, the heck are, where are they? And I say, Miss Parks, excuse me a minute, I have to check on some of the children. And I went all over the school looking for them. And I found the two girls. Now, they were supposed to be in the auditorium because one of them was the one who played Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. And but I wasn't looking for them for that reason. I was concerned.
Right.
And so I finally found them in the girls' restroom. And I said, girls, what are you doing in here? And they were holding each other's hands, and they were crying, just wailing. And I said, what is it? What happened? I'm really concerned now. And they say, Ms. Rosa Parks is at our school. She came to our little old school in East Oakland. She's really here, Erica. Rosa Parks is at our school. And I said, yes, she is. And they started crying, and snot was running out of their noses, and their tears are flowing. And then I started to cry, and then we were all hug. And I said, let's blow our noses. Let's wipe our eyes. Let's go back in. We have this play. But they were so touched that this really amazing woman would take the time to be with them. And she asked their names, and she wanted to know who wrote the play and how did they... It was a remarkable moment, and I don't think anybody there that day forget.
This brings me to a really important point that Jean makes about the divided feeling that Rosa Parks had about being a symbol. Yeah. Like on the one hand, you know, the press would lock her into this moment and as if nothing else happened before or after, and also put so much emphasis on that moment as if there wasn't a movement. At the same time, she understood her role as a symbol, because for us, and I forgive me for saying us, I mean black people, there is something quite moving and powerful about her experience in being close up as a kid.
Yes.
I remember when at PS28 in New York, Marian Anderson came to our school, and it was a huge thing. My sister got to give her some flowers on stage. And for those of us who knew who Marian Anderson was, it was the most amazing thing. Now, of course, she's an icon. But sometimes there are certain moments when, even as problematic as icons can be, it could be so uplifting for people who feel like they are forgotten or devalued, you know? Now, I was wondering if you could, both of you could reflect on the costs and consequences of that being an icon, but also, you know, the benefits, for kids like these kids, what that meant.
I don't think those children, because they were probably 9 and 10, something like that, I don't think they understood the concept of icon. Mm-hmm. They just knew that she'd done so many great things in her life and helped so many people. And there she was in their lives, in their world. And they were just so surprised and amazed that their lives were of consequence to hers.
Right. But how did they know that she was so important?
Because we talked about Rosa Parks, exactly. But we didn't talk about her as if she was on a pedestal.
Right. But as a historical figure.
This human woman. Right. I mean, we talked about everyone in that way. I mean, so many people came to visit that school. Maya Angelou came and was so touched. She came back with James Baldwin, mm-hmm. who cried the whole day he was there.
Right.
He just couldn't believe that
right.
children, black children, Latino children, were being educated in the heart of the community.
Right.
And certainly there were flaws in the school, because we were doing something that no one had told us how, and mm-hmm. you know, had it lived on, because it didn't, we would have improved all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted the children to know that there were so many people all over the world who cared about the quality of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you're speaking to. But we didn't think of her as an icon. And I think for me, she represented the kind of woman that from age 15 I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the person who touched me that day was Lena Horne. She didn't speak, but all she did was sing the word freedom.
Wow.
That was it. That was it. It landed first on my ears and then in my heart. And that's why I made that vow.
Mm-hmm.
If Lena Horne could stand up for her people, then so can I. And then it continued. So when I met Rosa Parks that day, I thought, there is a purpose to what I'm doing.
Wow.
Because I get tired, you know, of being the long distance person. But she was not tired. So there was no reason for me to have a pity party. You know what I mean? So she was still going, and Jean's book mm-hmm. is so inspiring in that way, because we all live in coinciding identities. There's no, you know, like, there's no one facet to any human being. And there were so many things about her that make her life so rich. So it's hard for me to think of her as an icon,
exactly.
and I can't hold her that way. Because I know, having read this, and I'm trying not to give things away, that she felt lonely.
Mm-hmm.
She suffered.
Right.
And she wasn't put forward. She was the poster person for the civil rights movement. Her image was managed. And it didn't have to be that way. What is so wonderful is that she kept going, and you told stories earlier today about this, that she'd meet challenges and they would, you know, bowl someone else over, and she just moved forward every time.
Okay. Anne want to address this, and then we're going to open up for questions.
I mean, I think it was a, I mean, she was an extremely private person, and so I think she really struggled with this role. But to, I mean, Black History to Rosa Parks was such a transformative discovery. She was a very sick kid, mm-hmm. and at some point around age, from what I can tell, 7 or 8 or 9, she reads this book. She probably shouldn't have read it. And it was a book called Is the Negro a Beast? Mm-hmm. And it was a
beast?
A beast, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's it was a book looking, there was all sorts of books of sort of scientific, we would now describe them as scientific racism. And this is a book that's sort of challenging that scientific racism, but still basically treating Black people as sort of unequal and inferior. And it was devastating. And she talks about this. This is one of her kind of clearest memories as a young person. And she talks about how she had no idea how she would be able to answer this. And so a few years later, the discovery of Black history was transformative because this was the answer to that. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of understanding how, I mean, Rosa Parks answers thousands of letters. She goes to hundreds of school programs. She goes to hundreds of church programs. She schleps around the country year after year after year after year. And I think understanding why she does that is in part about understanding the importance that she placed on history and the ways that she saw history as about taking the struggle forward. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, we can think about the ways that she then gets trapped in that, that it doesn't always work out the way that she thinks it's, you know, so that she talks about how she would go places and people would ask her if she knew Harry Tubman. And so she gets, I mean, there's a way that she's being trapped in that role and trapped in the past in ways that, you know, are not what she's trying to do with right. that, right? But that the power of history and the necessity of history to the struggle was so fundamental to her, right? That she was just, in some sense, willing to be the symbol because she understood that movements need symbols and that part of what she had agreed upon when she agreed to be the test case, right? That first night, they come back to her apartment after she's been bailed out and they want her, Edie Nixon, wants her to be the test case. And I think in that moment, she understood that part of what she was doing was being willing to be the symbol, right? But that came with a lot of cost and it came in some sense in counter to her, you know, maybe not contradiction, but not coming out of sort of what she liked, right? She didn't like that. And she longed for privacy and she longed not to have to talk about that day. And she talked about that having to, it was like pulling a scab off over and over and over. So it was very, I think that the work of being a symbol is a very right. difficult work. Right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay, so now we can open up for questions from the audience. Oh, and we have someone with the mic. I'll let you.
I want to thank you for writing the book.
Oh, yes, Anne.
Okay. Yeah. I'm from Detroit. I worked for Congressman Conyers, and I worked with Rosa Parks.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think a lot of people don't know, I like how you've talked about her as being a symbol. But in Detroit, Rosa was magical. She would call the office. She was in charge of constituent services. And she would call the office, and she would talk to people about their veterans' benefits. She would talk to them about Medicare. She would talk to them about all of those social services. And once someone realized who they were talking to, they just couldn't believe it. Wow. I mean, yeah. they wanted to just ask her a million questions. And she was reticent. And I believe she was shy. She wasn't a real outgoing person and very private. Right. But whenever people walked into the office and saw her, it transformed them. Right. It really did. And she did understand that. My brother was in high school when I was working there. And he came in and he just stood there and he couldn't say, he said, Mrs. Parks, I am so honored to meet you. And she took his hand and she said, "I am so honored to meet you." And she then engaged him in talking about himself. He wanted to ask her all about her experience, and she wanted to know about him. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about going to that school and all of the trips she made, she wanted to relate to people. She wanted them to talk to her about what they were experiencing. Right. And the only other thing I want to say is, I was involved in the women's movement in Detroit and in Michigan. Rosa was a feminist. Mm-hmm. She came to our events. She did participate. She helped organize, and she spoke. She was indefatigable. When people talk about how she got tired on that bus, I get mad.
Right.
She wasn't tired. Yeah. Right. She knew exactly what she was doing. And thank you so much for writing about her. I think it's so important because she needs to be lifted up. Thank you.
Thank you.
As I understand it, anyway, thank you very much. It's a wonderful presentation. I'm looking forward to reading the book. As I understand it, there's a huge quantity of Rosa Parks' personal papers that are basically stuck in a warehouse in upstate New York. And I'm not really sure what the status of all of that is or what the obstruction is, but can you, do you know about that? Can
Absolutely, you tell us? Yeah. So when Rosa Parks died, there was a huge dispute over her estate between her, and she starts an institute in 1987 with Elaine Steele. In many ways, Rosa Parks put her faith in young people from, you know, across her life. And in the late 80s, she felt that adults were too complacent. And so again, when she starts her institute, it's very much geared towards young people. So there is, unfortunately, a huge dispute over her estate after she passes away between her institute, which she left most of her estate to, mm-hmm. and her nieces and nephews. And the probate judge basically, and I think everybody probably saw money, and so the probate judge in the dispute takes all of her material, so this is all of her papers and all of her material effects, so her gowns and her glasses and her hats, and gives it all to a celebrity auction house in New York City with the stipulation that it all has to be sold all together. And again, for people, lovers of libraries, people understand that institutions that can handle papers are not necessarily the institutions who can handle material effects. So there are very few institutions that are going to have the resources. And then it is price tagged at sort of, you know, $6 to $8 million.
Yeah, no good
point. This has been sitting in a New York warehouse for the past 5 years. And then I think on top of that, one of the worst things is that they have allowed no scholar to see it, to assess the papers. And again, I think that this brings us back to the way that Rosa Parks is kind of trapped in this children's book figure, in that I don't think you could imagine auctioning papers of Martin Luther King, auctioning papers of Robert Kennedy, auctioning papers of Eleanor Roosevelt, and not allowing a scholar to assess them.
Because
she is sort of treated like this, in this sort of weird sort of honor, but also smallness, mm-hmm. They have allowed no scholars in. And the papers, and I mean, all of it is still sitting there. And it's not clear what's going to happen. So in many ways, one of the hardest things about writing this book was writing the book without getting to see those papers. There's an inventory, and so, you know, there's lots of suggestive things in there. Just to tell you one thing, there are letters from Audley Moore, who is Queen Mother Moore, right, to mm-hmm. Rosa Parks in the late 50s, which suggests really interesting connections between what people are doing in Montgomery and sort of other parts of sort of the black left and other black radicals. And I don't think that the auction house even realizes. They just have on the, you know, letter 1957, right. Audley Moore. So I do think when those papers are, if they're, you know, when and if they're ever open, there's going to be a much richer sense, much, much richer sense than I could do in the book, of kind of the texture of her, of her, of her personal life, but particularly of her political life. So, thank you.
The questions of who does own those papers then at this point? And then I'm curious, I don't know, how old was Ms. Parks when this happened, when she refused to give up her seat? Because you talk about how she had like 20 years of activism before then. So
right.
Put it in a timeline, please.
Beautiful. She's 42 years old on December 1st, 1955, when she refuses to give up her seat on the bus. So it's true, she's right in the middle of her life. She's been an activist. She marries Raymond when I think she's 19. So she has those 2 decades beforehand. And then she spends, again, more than half of her political life. She moves to Detroit in 57, and she will die in 2005 at the age of 92. So she spends more than half of her life in the North, right? Which, again, disrupts our conceptions. Mm-hmm. In terms of who owns the papers, nobody exactly does. Basically, when they sell, the money will be distributed to her institute and her family. But they are in the control, I guess they're partially in the control of the court, the probate court, and they're partially in the control right now of Guernsey's auction house in New York City. And if you can Google Guernsey's, and you can go to their website, and it says the Rosa Parks Archive. So that's sort of.
When will it be decided when they're sold?
Well, basically nobody, the problem is a kind of a two or threefold problem, I think. The first problem is, I think there are very few institutions that can afford that. I mean, that it's exorbitant, because if you're imagining buying that, you're still going to have to build something to house it and take care of it, right? This is an astronomical amount of money. The second thing is, most institutions could handle papers or they could handle material effects, right? There are very few institutions that can handle both of those. So I think for many institutions, it's very intimidating. And there certainly are institutions that would want the papers, or that would want, you know, to do a more museum display. So I think that's the second problem. And then, frankly, I think the third problem is they haven't let scholars in. People don't understand how important that is. That we understand that the papers of Martin Luther King don't just speak about Martin Luther King. They speak about the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They speak about the presidency in the 1960s. They speak about the nature of the Black church. They speak about a whole range of things. And again, I think this is where we need to change how we see Rosa Parks, because I think when you think about the papers of Rosa Parks, you think about like kids going, right? And you don't think about them as important historical sort of materials that are going to change how we think about American society and race and the international struggle in the 20th century. So I think that's sort of the third.
Next question. Hi, thank you so much. I understood that she was selected to that day to not give up her seat, but what I'm interested in knowing is, why was this the catalyst that created this whole movement? In other words, you had stated that it had happened before, mm-hmm. that women and men had refused to give up their seats. What caused this to be the tipping point?
Two things. One, she was not selected to do it that day. So there are two myths that come up in the first days of the bus boycott. The first myth is that she's just a tired seamstress, right? And that myth kind of comes up because this is in the middle of the Cold War. And almost immediately, rumors circulate in the white community that she is a communist, she's an NAACP plant, she's Mexican, she's not even from Montgomery, she has a car, all these rumors.
To the car.
But what you can see at the heart of the rumors, right? The heart of the rumors are that she is illegitimate and she is an outside agitator and this is not organic, right? And part of those rumors is that she is a plant, that she is, that this has all been planned. So So there's the myth that she's a plant, and then there's the myth that she then, part of the ways that people then you see black leaders in Montgomery, Rosa Parks herself, the black press, start to refer to her as a good Christian woman, as a seamstress. And you see the way she's being talked about change within the first few weeks. And so her political, her larger political life sort of drops out. She becomes a Christian seamstress. She was certainly picked as a test case, but she wasn't selected to do what she did on the bus. But I think why that act is so important is a couple of things. Earlier that year, a 15-year-old by the name of Claudette Colvin had resisted on the bus, had refused to give up her seat, had been arrested and manhandled by police. And this is a young, very small 15-year-old. And this enrages the black community. And people are very upset, and there is some mobilization. And ultimately, a movement does not emerge, in part because I think people, she's not the right face. Mm-hmm. And for all sorts of reasons, she's too feisty, she's emotional, she's too young, she's too poor, she's too dark. So there are all sorts of reasons, troubling reasons as well, why she does not become kind of, why the movement doesn't happen then. But I do not think we can understand why the movement happens with Rosa Parks without understanding Claudette Colvin. Right. Because I think Claudette Colvin is a bit of a, to use a kind of Christian metaphor, a John the Baptist sort of figure. And so in part, I think people... Martin Luther King talks that very first mass meeting about how a people get tired, right? And this is not about physical tiredness, right? It's about the cup runneth over. And so I think part of what happens and why people get to a breaking point with Rosa Parks. I think the second reason why she's a catalyst is because she sits in this really interesting class position in the black community. She is working class. Mm. As I mentioned, she's living in the projects. Her husband's a barber. She's working, she's doing seamstress work, but she's very demure in demeanor. So she's sort of middle class in demeanor and working class. She lives on Montgomery's working class west side. That's going to be sort of the heart of the boycott, are people on Montgomery's west side. But middle class black people in Montgomery's black community also identify with her, also see the potential, sort of see in her arrest that it could be them. And so I argue in the book that it is that kind of, we could say, liminal space, right, that so many people identify with her that also becomes a kind of galvanizing, why she becomes a galvanizing figure. And then the third thing is, even though her politics gets stripped out of her the way that she becomes a symbol, I do think they're key to why people get, trust her. Because they know that she's brave, and they know that she understands what she's, you know, kind of signing up for. Right. And so I think there's a way that they understand she's not going to flinch in the kind of pressure that's going to get brought on anybody who makes this kind of stand.
Right. Well, there's another reason, too, which your book clearly shows that you had a community that's already organized.
Absolutely.
In other words... sometimes we think that the catalyst produces organization, when actually organization sometimes produces the catalyst.
Right.
And you show very clearly not only the constant war on the buses and with the police, but the fact that Claudette Colvin was a mentee,
right, mm-hmm,
of Rosa Parks.
Right.
That Rosa Parks worked with the Youth Council and with all these young people, and she was doing all this work ahead of time. So that the foundations are laid. I think it's a really important critical political lesson for all of us, because we think somehow we need some event or some individual to lead, when in fact the foundation for leadership is already being laid ahead of time, you know, the groundwork.
But right, right.
One more question, sir. Yeah.
Save the best for last.
Yeah.
I just want to touch about the white folks in Montgomery, and wasn't it a white lady that bailed her out?
Mm-hmm. So Rosa Parks was working at Montgomery Fair, but she was sewing on the side for one of the few white sort of civil rights act like supporters in Montgomery, and that was Clifford and Virginia Durr. And so she's sewing for the Durrs. It is Virginia Durr who recommends Rosa Parks to go to Highlander Folk School the summer before she makes her bus stand. Highlander Folk School is an adult organizer training school. So Rosa Parks goes there for 2 weeks in August of 1955. And it is... So basically, when she's arrested, someone on the bus goes to tell Edie Nixon that she's been arrested. He tries to call the police station to find out what's happened. They won't tell a black person what's happened. So he gets the Durrs to call. And it is the Durrs that... and Clifford Durr finds out she's been arrested on a segregation charge. And so Clifford, Virginia, and Edie Nixon make their way down to bail her out. Meanwhile, she has gotten a call home, and so Raymond also makes his way. So she is bailed out by Raymond, Virginia, Clifford Durr, and Edie Nixon. But that is sort of, yes, so she is, and certainly, as I mentioned, it is Virginia Durr who does a lot of the fundraising the year of the boycott that keeps the Parks family alive, that she's sort of raising money for Rosa Parks. I wanted to say how incredibly honored I am to be here, in part because this is an amazing, amazing library. Mm-hmm. And
right.
And the project I did before this book was actually a project on the civil rights movement in Los Angeles, in particular the civil rights movement around schools in Los Angeles in the 1960s. And I spent many, many hours in this amazing library. And so to get to be back here talking about Rosa Parks is just a huge honor. And so I just wanted to say thank you to the library for having us, and to Erica and Robin for
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.